From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Dearborn man accused of killing two Irish soldiers in Lebanon 34 years ago now faces deportation.
Ozzy may have brought this on himself. He applied for citizenship last year after living here for 20 or so years on a green card.
How Berrien County is taking a fresh approach with young offenders.
It's important that we help kids learn various skills, be more effective in managing conflict, make better decisions. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we needed to move the needle on recidivism.
And we meet the actors bringing beloved Tigers announcer Ernie Harwell to life each night on a Detroit stage.
You just mention Ernie to somebody and they, oh, everybody has a story.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. It's a brave new world out there for teachers. 3D printers, 3D projectors, Google Glass. But how do we know if new gadgets help or hurt in the classroom? I'm Cynthia Canty. Also today, one ballpark, two competing visions. New progress on plans to redevelop the old Tiger Stadium site some 15 years after the Tigers played their last home game. But first, a 71-year-old ice cream man was arrested Tuesday at his Dearborn home on an immigration violation. Mahmoud Bazzi is accused of the torture killings of two Irish soldiers in Lebanon in 1980. The soldiers were part of the UN peacekeeping mission in southern Lebanon. A third Irish soldier was shot but survived. Bazzi moved to the United States shortly after the killings and settled in Dearborn. Jim Schaefer's been covering this story for the Detroit Free Press. Jim, just what happened at Mahmoud Bazzi's home in Dearborn yesterday?
Well, immigration officials went there and picked him up 34 years after he is suspected of having taken part in the abduction and possible shooting deaths of two Irishmen who were soldiers as part of a peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, and the wounding of a third soldier. Ostensibly, they arrested Mr. Bazzi on an immigration violation. We've learned from Bazzi himself that he entered the country about 21 years ago on somebody else's passport. So that's the violation that our government is now holding him on and intends to deport him on.
Jim, take us back to what was going on with the Lebanese Civil War and what happened to those soldiers on April 18th, 1980. The country was in the middle of a fierce civil war.
Well, there was a civil war going on at the time in Lebanon, many different factions, a lot of chaos, and Israel at one point had been attacked in the late 1970s. So they invaded southern Lebanon to defend their interests. The United Nations brokered a treaty in which Israel had to recede back within its borders, but the UN installed a peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon at the time. And the Irish have always been great about supplying troops for peacekeeping forces. This wasn't the first time they had done it, and they're still doing it today, actually. So they sent lots of troops that were installed in southern Lebanon to keep the peace between the different factions that were fighting there. There was a Christian militia that was backed by Israel. Israel sort of left them there in their stead to protect the Israeli border. And, of course, there was a Palestine Liberation Organization and other factions in the region at the time. So the Irish were there to keep the peace.
And what happened to those three soldiers that day?
Well, as often happens when you've got so many different competing interests in a war zone, skirmishes developed. The Christian militia would sometimes, as the Irish soldiers I've talked to have said to me in recent days when I've interviewed them, there were a lot of mind games going on. They would shell the Irish encampment, even giving them warnings sometimes that, hey, we're going to be doing this in a few minutes. So no one had really gotten injured or killed, certainly. But at one point, things became very tense, and the Irish retaliated to what they called, what they described as attacks from the Christian militia. And there was a firefight, and an Irish soldier was killed, and then a defense force, one of the militia, Christian militia guys, were killed, the Lebanese people. This created chaos, even more so than normal down there. And for 10 days, there was a lot of rhetoric going on. One commander went on the radio and let it be known from the Lebanese side that they wanted the blood of two Irish soldiers in retaliation for this killing of the Lebanese man who was part of the militia, or they wanted blood money, about $10,000 to be paid. In the meantime, the Irish were trying to get their troops out of there. They had checkpoints all the way down to the Israeli border, and the furthest one had not been relieved or resupplied. So they sent in these three soldiers, actually with an American major as an escort. An American journalist accompanied them to see how things were going to go, and he was going to write a story about it, and they all ended up being abducted.
And then?
And then, according to people I've interviewed, including the American journalist who has written about it himself earlier this year, Steve Hendy, he worked for the Associated Press. He's based out of New York, but was sent over there to cover all this chaos that was going on. Mohammed Bazzi, as they called him back then, he now goes by Mahmoud Bazzi, led this group of men, armed men, who stopped these three United Nations vehicles, abducted everyone who was there and took them to an abandoned schoolhouse, separated the Irish from the Americans and a couple of French guys who were there, let those guys stand outside the school while they took them down to the basement, while they took the Irish down to the basement, and opened fire. According to one soldier who was wounded but survived, who I interviewed in recent days, Mohammed Bazzi was the guy who did this. Now, the killing didn't happen at the school. Bazzi allegedly, the two of the Irish soldiers took off but were recaptured outside by Bazzi's men and were loaded into a Peugeot that Steve Hendy, the American journalist, described to me as pulling off with Bazzi at the wheel. He saw the Irish soldiers turn around, and Hendy describes the look on one of their faces as sheer terror. And that was the last anybody had ever seen of them until their bodies turned up later that day, tortured and killed.
And Mohammed Bazzi talked, or Mahmoud Bazzi, talked to reporters in Lebanon shortly after the killings and said, yes, I did it?
Yeah, he went on television and claimed credit for it and went so far as to say, if any more Irishmen come down here, they're gonna meet the same fate. Now, I've interviewed Bazzi myself. Of course, he lives in Dearborn, and we talked to him before he was arrested yesterday. And he says he was there. He admits it. He also says that he went on camera and claimed credit for these killings. Now, what he says, though, is that he was forced to go on camera by one of the commanders of the Christian militia and claim credit, the commander forcing him to do so by saying, I'm going to harm your family if you don't do it. So he says he did go on camera, he was there, but he did not take part in any of the violence that happened. He left before this went on. Now, that's tough to explain when there's a video that that says otherwise, but that's the challenge that we have here, figuring out what the truth is.
And 34 years later, Jim, why is it that Immigration and Customs move now? I know it's been a campaign in Ireland, but not very well known here.
Well, you know, Bazzi may have brought this on himself. He applied for citizenship last year. After living here for 20 or so years on a green card, he decided to make it official and try to get his citizenship. Now, his family describes it to me as wanting to get benefits and be able to survive. Right now, he's not eligible for those kinds of things because he's not a citizen. So he applied for citizenship, and lo and behold, Homeland Security did some background checks on him, according to the people I've interviewed, and called Steve Hendy, the journalist, and made contact through the embassy with the surviving Irish soldier, who I've also interviewed, who lives in Killarney, Ireland. And both of them described the scenario that I just explained to you. This isn't the first time the U.S. has heard it, by the way. They've investigated as far back as 2003, I'm told, but nothing ever happened until Bazzi decided to apply for citizenship. We started poking around on this a few weeks ago, and back then when I talked to United States officials, they would not confirm or deny that they were investigating the guy. I was surprised by yesterday's arrest because it has been 34 years. So the people in Ireland who I spoke to yesterday, including the daughter of one of the slain soldiers, Karen Barrett, her father Thomas Barrett was one of these guys who was killed, are very relieved that that some action has happened, but they are hoping that this isn't the end. You know, they want the Bazzi to face charges on the actual shooting and abduction that happened that day. So we are not sure whether that's going to happen. The U.S. immigration officials will not comment on that. I should say also that I've spoken with Bazzi's daughter. He's got three in the United States who are totally Americanized, who are citizens as well, and they are obviously upset about this and believe their father is innocent.
What comes next for Mahmoud Bazzi of Dearborn?
He's got a removal hearing next week, which is a deportation hearing where the government will try to argue before an immigration judge that he should lose his right to live in this country. Whether that leads to any further discussion of whether he was involved in the in these attacks on the soldiers, we will see. They're being quite quiet about that subject at the moment. The U.S. government is.
Jim Schaefer is a staff writer for the Detroit Free Press who has been following this story. Thanks for the update, Jim.
Oh, anytime, Cynthia.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. In 1960, Ernie Harwell became the voice of the Detroit Tigers. In September 2009, as he battled cancer, the Hall of Famer made his final bow at Comerica Park.
In my almost 92 years on this earth, the good Lord has blessed me with a great journey. And the blessed part of that journey is that it's going to end here in the great state of Michigan. I deeply appreciate the people of Michigan. I love their grit. I love the way they face life. I love the family values they have. And you Tiger fans are the greatest fans of all. No question about that.
It's a measure of how much Michiganders loved Ernie back that Mitch Albom's play Ernie is now running for its fourth summer at the City Theater in the Hockey Town Cafe in Detroit. Two actors bring us this powerful story, and they're with us today. Peter Carey playing Ernie Harwell. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
And back for a fourth season as The Boy, we welcome T.J. Corbett. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Peter, this play actually is set on that final night at Comerica Park in 2009. Give us a sense of how the story's framed.
Well, you know who sets it up the best is T.J.
as
The Boy. Because here's the thing. He sets this whole thing up for Ernie. You're right. It is at Comerica Park. But there's a little twist on it.
It's on, like you said, the final night. He gives the farewell speech, and Ernie was a very humble, self-effacing guy. So he's kind of talking out into, you know, the fourth wall and says, well, Lulu, it's time for me to come home. And he's about to leave when seemingly out of nowhere, this kid dressed in 1930s clothing shows up and says, I want to hear your broadcast. And Ernie says, well, I don't broadcast games anymore. And the kid says, well, I want to hear the broadcast of your life. So Ernie tells the kid the nine innings of his life.
And the kid has to work a little to get him because Ernie's so effacing.
Yeah.
He wants to
it's
go home to Lulu.
Got a lot of practice at being annoying. So,
well, TJ, you've been doing this play now. This is since it first opened in 2011. What most strikes you over these years about the audience reactions that you get?
It's because when I was growing up, like I had listened to Ernie, but you know, as a when he was on regularly, as like a 7 and 8 year old, I was like, oh, Ernie Harwell. I love Ernie Harwell. I was like Power Rangers. So there's – as I've gotten older, I kind of remember who he is. But kind of like hearing about the play and then going like Ernie Harwell and then finding like all this stuff that had been just like lying around the house all those years. It's like, oh, my gosh. We've got a bunch of baseball and Ernie Harwell stuff lying around the house.
It means a lot to a lot of people.
Yeah, it means a lot to a lot of people. And what I guess what strikes me the most is the people who come back, really. I mean, a lot of times people see a play and go, oh, that was great. That was great. We'll talk about that forever. But they just keep coming back. Sometimes more than once in a season, let alone people who come just once a year for the new run.
We had a gentleman the other night say, this is my third time seeing the play, and it's my first time seeing you as Ernie.
Mm-hmm.
So that people come back. They love the feeling, the mm-hmm. energy that Ernie is and was. I say is because you just mention Ernie to somebody and they, oh, everybody has a story.
And when, as you talk to people, and now we should note that this is your first time leading as Ernie. You were understudy, so this
right.
is your first season. So you're coming out. People are waiting, but you're also seeing and feeling from the audience. What is it, do you think, people love about this man?
Well, I think we've mentioned this previously, that TJ and I, that when you were with Ernie, you were his best friend. You were the most important person in that room because he made you feel that way, and you got his full attention. And he was the most endearing individual I've ever met and worked with. And I was thrilled to have the opportunity.
So here you are portraying this icon. He is beloved. He's iconic. How do you take someone who's that important to people and make it something that has audiences going, ah, yeah, that's Ernie, but not be doing an impersonation? Was that a tough balance to strike?
It is. That's a great question. You don't want to be an impersonator. You want to channel Ernie. You want to respect his spirit and who he was, and at the same time, give people a sense of, come along on this journey with us through the nine innings of Ernie's life. And working with TJ has been wonderful because we've really had an opportunity to explore not only Ernie's life, but how to best portray it and share it with people.
Mm-hmm. How do you work at that, TJ?
Well, oh, he's just good.
Sometimes you just got it. But I guess a lot of it is, and the gentleman who played Ernie previously, Will Young, had, I guess, he phrased it in a way that I guess just kind of came about from the little, like, talkbacks they do, is we're careful to not make him a caricature, but he's a character. And it's not, you know, people understand that they're not coming to see a 92-year-old man. They're coming to see a character portrayed as a 92-year-old man, and I think it kind of helps with us finding the fun in it and finding the back and forth in the play.
Mm-hmm.
And like Peter said, really embodying that spirit, like that humility, but that joyous, embracing, just
he found
human
joy
being.
In everything. You're
yeah,
right.
Yeah, he was just humanist. Is that the right word? I don't want to misspeak.
But this is also a man at this time who knows he's dying.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Very aware he's dying.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
That brings a whole different level to your acting and how you experience this whole thing. And that's one of the things I want to give a big shout out to Will for building Ernie for the first 3 years and doing such a wonderful job. And as an understudy for the last 2 years, I learned a lot from him, and I dearly love Will. And when Mitch came and said, okay, we're bringing you up from the farm leagues. You know,
moving up from Toledo.
That's right. He's coming up from the mud hens. So that was a big step, and you take a giant leap in from understudy to lead. You bring some things that you want to do.
If you have just joined us, we are talking about the play Ernie, Mitch Albom's play, now in its fourth summer at the City Theater in Detroit, as we talk with Peter Carey, who plays Ernie Harwell, and TJ Corbett, who plays the boy. And I'm wondering, would you share a scene with us?
Sure. We could probably... Do you have a favorite you'd like to do?
Yeah, I saw it last Friday, and there is a point toward the end where the boy and Ernie are talking, and Ernie kind of goes through his... calls.
Oh, the iconic calls.
The iconic calls, and then a recognition of where he's at in his life.
Two for the price of one.
I'm sorry?
What you'd say in a double play? Do it, please.
Grounded to Trammell, over to Whitaker to Evans, that's two for the price of one.
Yeah, do another.
Strike three looking, he's called out for excessive window shopping.
Yes.
That one is long gone.
Long gone.
Long gone. Like me pretty soon. I'm dying.
I know.
I got this thing in my bile duct. Cancer. They can't operate. I wouldn't want them to. I don't want to go out in pieces, radiated, cut up and vomiting. I'm 91 years old. You can just say goodbye and be grateful, right?
Are you afraid of dying?
And then we go into a very emotional.
Yes, we do. And there was sniffling galore from the audience, which.
I love telling the husbands, like, bring tissue. And yeah. I like, look at the wife and I'm like, make him bring a tissue.
Because they do. And we heard lots of snuffling around it. And it also struck me as I watched the audience, you did have a good number of older people that you knew grew up with Ernie. But there were younger folks there too, and the sniffling was pretty, widespread. But Peter, you come out, both of you, and talked to audience members after, and you had a special conversation the other night with someone with the last name of Hardwell. Talk about that to us.
Well, for us, for TJ and I to come out and see this, there was this big hulking gentleman out in the lobby, and he had this thick Georgia twang, and he introduced himself to us, and then we're in awe because it's Ernie Harwell's nephew. And he introduced us to his wife and his son. Now, not giving away a lot about the play, but there is, in the early innings, he talks about his brother Davis. And, well, this is Davis's son, and his son is named after his grandfather, so his name is Davis. And
we didn't put this together till after the show.
After the whole show.
Everybody went home, and then we're like, wait a minute, was that Davis's son?
Yeah, we're texting each other going, wait, is this... And so it unfolds for us later on, but it's very moving because we were talking to him, and you wonder, how did you honor the man to this family member? And he said, we had tissues out 2 minutes in, and his wife gave me a big hug and a kiss, and she said, you have no idea what you did in terms of bringing him back. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was she was barely hanging on the whole time. I mean, it was like she was on... Right on that fence of just breaking down into tears.
And we're with her.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie.
Tears. That does really hammer at home what really a responsibility it is to do honor to this man that's so beloved by so many. You know, as we saw the play last weekend, it really struck me that Ernie is really a story about more than sports, that it takes us through so much of the 20th century in America and in Michigan through Ernie's eyes. And I'm wondering what each of you think. What was Ernie Harwell's Michigan?
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Do you want to take that one first?
I guess you haven't been asked that question before.
No. That's why I love coming here.
I say go read his poem, Baseball.
Yeah.
That, I think, is probably the biggest thing. Listen to the sound clip they played at the beginning of this, too. And then I think it's everything Michigan. Go to Tiger Stadium. Go to Detroit. Go to... I mean, I don't know where he traveled. I'm sure it's in some of his books. Just, I'm sure Michigan was home for him. So
he loved it and was loved by it.
Yes.
It was this exchange of energy and love and respect. And he honestly was heartbroken when Tiger Stadium was torn down.
Yeah.
And there's a line in our play that came straight from him. When they tore Tiger Stadium down, it felt like they were taking a piece of me, too. And... So it is. It's a mutual love. It's an admiration. And he was an icon and still is. You go to Comerica Park and you tap on that bronze statue.
Yeah, absolutely, every time.
I get a little tingle.
Well, Mitch Albom's Ernie runs now through August 17th at the City Theater inside the Hockey Town Cafe in Detroit. And we got more than a tingle watching that play. Mitch's play is beautiful, and you both really brought that story to life tremendously powerful way. You can get ticket information through OlympiaEntertainment.com or Ticketmaster. Peter Carey, TJ Corbett, thank you so much. It has been 15 years since the Detroit Tigers played their last game at the corner of Michigan and Trumbull. The old Tiger Stadium was torn down in 2009. Since then, no one's been able to agree on just what to do with that 10-acre site. Until now, perhaps. Detroit Free Press business writer John Gallagher is here to tell us about recent developments that could bring new life to a beloved piece of land. John, have we actually seen compromise on something?
Well, we have, Cynthia. What happened is that the city agencies that handle this agreed with the Detroit Police Athletic League, Detroit PAL, which is a youth sports organization, to have Detroit PAL take over this site, basically, or most of the site. And they will maintain the historic playing field and then build their new headquarters along one side where the stadium used to be. Some of the frontages on Michigan Avenue and Trumbull will be saved for future development of more commercial development. So the playing field will remain intact, and it'll more or less be ringed by new development.
So this sounds like it keeps everybody happy, because haven't there been two very strongly held views on what should be done to that site?
Right, and I'm not sure that it's quite right to say everybody's happy is that everybody's equally unhappy. I think the preservation is wanted a completely devoted to a baseball-only kind of organization, and maybe even rebuilding some stands and so on, and having a minor league team play there or something like that, whereas some of the more development-type advocates wanted the entire site turned into new commercial development. So what you're getting is a compromise in which you get the historic playing field remaining as is for youth sports, not just baseball, but youth sports of all types, and then redevelopment, more commercial redevelopment, along the Michigan and Trumbull frontages. So I think everybody gets a little something out of this.
And I think it was important, was it not, to the old Tiger Stadium Conservancy Group that at least the footprint of the original diamond be preserved. And that would happen under this plan?
Yes, that's what happens. The original baseball playing surface remains intact. I think it's interesting, as Detroit PAL moves ahead and they intend to sponsor all kinds of youth activities here. You might have a soccer thing, in which case they'd have to take the old pitcher's mound and maybe flatten it out to play soccer and then rebuild it for a baseball or something like that. So I think you'll see some changes over time, but the footprint of the playing field will remain the same.
And private developers, it's now up to them to be submitting plans. Do we have a sense of what's in those plans? Are there any common features?
Well, we haven't seen any specific ones, but in general, the city is looking for mixed-use housing and commercial development. So some residential, maybe one of these buildings where you have retail on the first floor and housing above, or maybe a housing project here and a row of shops there, that sort of thing. So probably residential and retail is what they're really hoping to get. Relatively low-rise, maybe 2, 3, 4 stories, something like that.
Kind of in fitting with that whole Corktown feel.
Yes, exactly.
John, we've heard plans floated around for that Michigan and Trumbull site over these past years, and then they kind of vanish. Is there a reason to think that this could be it, that that site could become something more than a great big, you know, lawn that volunteers have to cut?
Right. Well, I think what's changed now is that we do have an agreement between the city and an organization that seems to have the wherewithal to make it happen. In the past, you either had plans being put forward by the city that were opposed by, say, the old Tiger Stadium and Conservancy, which has access to this $3 million earmark that Senator Levin came up with for redeveloping the site, which the Conservancy controls. So that stopped some. And then in other cases, other people were putting forward plans, but with no money and no authority over the site. So what we have now is an agreement between the city and the Conservancy and Detroit PAL to do this. So I think this obviously has the best chance of actually happening.
And what happens next?
Well, Detroit PAL has to raise some more money. They've got the $3 million that they've got from the earmark as a starting point. They need to raise somewhere between another $2 and $5 million more, depending on how many bells and whistles they want on their facility, which is going to be on the site. And then the city is going to select private developers to work on the Michigan and Trumbull frontages. Probably in August or September, they'll put forward a recommendation, which city council would have to approve and so on. But so in the next couple of months, we'll be hearing more about what else is going to go on the site.
John Gallagher, Detroit Free Press business writer. As always, thanks so much, John.
You betcha. Thank you.
As we heard on yesterday's show, the apparent key to reducing recidivism and helping people move from the world of convicts back to the everyday is not to make the corrections default position lock him up. And as seen in the European approach to corrections, keeping family ties as intact as possible is key. There's a juvenile justice plan in Berrien County that's been applying these principles since 2001, strengthening family ties, keeping young offenders out of jail whenever possible. And their approach is paying off. Elvin Gonzalez is the Family Division Administrator for Berrien County Trial Court. He's with us now. Elvin, what caused Berrien County to seek out a new approach to juvenile justice in 2001?
Sure. It's been a radical shift. I would call it a system change and a system reform. We changed, in essence, the approach that we dealt with youth. Rather than looking at them as individuals who come before the attention of the court and treat them in a kind of individualized manner, it was really important for us to look at the family system that that youth came from. What we found is that of those youth that came before the court, many of the factors that contributed to them being involved in delinquency came from two primary domains, their family domain and their school domain. Mm. And we knew we needed to address both of those domains and provide interventions that targeted those areas, strengthen the family's ability to supervise, effectively monitor, use effective discipline, and also support their children. Because we know that when we place kids in out-of-home care, over 90% of those youth return to their families. They come back home, and if the home situation is not improved, if it's not better able to support that youth, then they typically recidivate at high rates and regress.
So it sounds like rather than a sense of we're going to punish this young person for whatever he or she did, it's almost as if taking a therapeutic approach. What can we fix at home in that world in which that child came from?
There are both sides to that equation. You know, I want to make it very clear that accountability for one's decisions, whether you're a youth or a parent, or a youth who's brought before the court, is not forgotten in this approach. Personal accountability for one's decisions, and then helping families, helping youth make better decisions, learn more effective ways to conduct themselves in a community and not put the community at risk. Those go hand in hand. And so part of that was the idea that we needed to differentiate those youth who came before the court and use risk needs assessment instruments to help us, in essence, triage those youth and know who our more high-risk juvenile offenders were, what were the factors that were causing them to be high-risk to reoffend, and then effectively intervening with those factors and also supporting the family, the parents, the caregivers in learning better skills to effectively supervise, monitor, and manage their youth. Ultimately, our belief is that kids live in an ecology. That ecology is their family system, their neighborhood, their community, their school, and we needed to impact those areas to help youth be successful in our communities.
So based on when you have an offender and they go through this, as you accurately called it, a triage, they could wind up in a juvenile detention facility, or they could wind up, staying at home under intense supervision?
Yes, there's a range. We call it a continuum of services or a system of care. So we have a variety of interventions that look at the needs and the risks that the youth presents, and we match that youth and family to what their risk and needs are. So some youth who cannot be safely managed in the community may end up in more supervised, structured settings. That's a small number compared to what it was before. When I arrived here in 2001, we had over 125 youth from our county that were in out-of-home residential placements throughout Michigan and other states. Today, our numbers are under between 30 and 40 kids in out-of-home placement. So that's a significant reduction. And we were able to accomplish that because we could do a better job of assessing the risk and needs of these youth and families. And then we implemented evidence-based practices, evidence-based treatment programs that are demonstrated to be effective, that keep youth in their community, living at home, and the services are provided to the family and the youth in the community setting.
And I imagine the cost of that kind of approach is very favorable compared with the cost of sending some young offender, to a juvenile facility.
Absolutely, absolutely. What we found is that when youth went to an out-of-home residential placement, the average length of stay was anywhere between 12 to 14 months. The average cost per youth was between $80,000 and $90,000 to treat one youth in residential placement, where we could treat a youth and their family in the community with these intensive services for approximately anywhere between $5,000 to $8,000 per youth. So it's a substantial cost savings. The other strategy that we did is we approached our funding unit and we said we believe we can more effectively work with these youth and families by providing these intensive services in the community. Would you allow us to reinvest the savings by reducing the number of youth we send to residential placement to reinvest that into the community to support these community-based programs? And our funding unit agreed to that.
And Elvin, I saw one figure that said recidivism dropped from more than 58% in 1998 to 17.5% in 2012. That has to be a very encouraging trend.
Absolutely, absolutely. Our court is committed to measuring what's meaningful and measuring what we do in terms of not only the outcomes of how many youth went to a particular program, did they complete the program successfully, but what happened after they received their service. That's what's where really the rubber meets the road. And we track our youth anywhere from 1 year to 18 months post-closure, when we close our case out. And we use a variety of databases to find out if they reoffended. If so, when did they reoffend? What types of crimes they commit? And so we track youth after they receive their interventions and their services, and that's how we gather our recidivism data. And what we realized is, for us as a juvenile justice organization, it's important that we help kids learn various skills, be more effective in managing conflict, make better decisions. Rehabilitate them, in essence. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we needed to move the needle on recidivism.
Yeah.
Unless we could show that we were dropping recidivism, then everything else was, well-intended effort. But at the end of the day, we needed to show that we were dropping that recidivism.
Elvin, are you aware of other counties taking this approach, or are you kind of trailblazing in Michigan?
Well, I think that more counties in Michigan are looking at how to do system change and to innovate their juvenile justice systems. And there's a number of significant efforts happening nationally. The MacArthur Foundation has been very strong behind the Models of Change initiative, which is really taking juvenile justice and examining current practice and how to align it more with evidence-based practices. There are counties in Michigan that have really reduced their numbers of kids in residential placement by doing many of the things that we've done. And I think this is a movement nationally. We really are looking at return on investment. As taxpayers, if we are providing funding that funds juvenile justice systems, just like we fund prisons and jails, we need to ask the fundamental question, are we making smart, wise use of those dollars, and are we getting the return on investment? Are we demonstrating that through our efforts, through our programs, through our services, by measuring what we do, that we are making the positive difference that we're supposed to make in public safety, holding youth accountable for their conduct, but also improving the lives of not only the youth and families we work with, but our general community?
Elvin Gonzalez is the Family Division Administrator for Berrien County Trial Court. Thanks for speaking with us today, Elvin.
You're welcome.
How should cutting-edge new technologies be used in the classroom? Sure, devices like Google Glass or a 3D printer are very cool, but how can they be used to teach and to learn? These are questions my next guest answers in his new role as Emerging Technologies Coordinator at Grand Valley State University. Eric Cunnan is with us. Eric, are you the guy bridging the gap between all the cool technology in the classroom?
I am one of the guys bridging the gap. I am very fortunate to be part of a exciting space in the new library here at Grand Valley State University, the Technology Showcase, sort of elevating and accelerating the topic of technology across the campus.
How?
Well, we are working with faculty and students. We have a lot of technology exhibits going on that rotate every quarter. For example, right now we have Google Glass, we have 3D printing, we have a coin mining display, we have telepresence, double robot. We have all sorts of interesting things for students and faculty to drop by and check out. The concept really is to interact, learn, discover, and share how technology can transform teaching and learning at the university.
Let's talk about some of the technology that you've got right now that you're exploring, Eric, because I'm interested in your thoughts on how these can really be well used in the classroom. Let's start with Google Glass.
So Google Glass, we became Google Glass Explorers in November of this year, and one of the kind of key concepts of the Technology Showcase in general is to bring in new, exciting, and innovative technology, and one of the technologies that's new, that's actually not even out yet, is Google Glass. And so we inquired those to be able to work with students and faculty to just ask questions like, well, what would it look like if everyone had Google Glass at the university? How would that change what we do in the classroom? How would that change what a faculty member's role is in the classroom? How would that change the laboratory experience? And so Google Glass right now is still an emerging technology, and so we're providing that access to try the Google Glass on in the showcase, and then also talking through with some faculty about potential uses of that technology in the classroom.
And that's what I'm wondering. So we're talking about the glasses with the little tiny computer on that right lens. What might a professor be able to use that to do that would be new and innovative and useful?
Well, you know, one of the exciting things about Google Glass is the ability to have hands-free operation. So, you know, if you can kind of think in terms of a visual demonstration, maybe in a science classroom where you need both hands as the instructor, or even in a music classroom where you're having to show or demonstrate something, having that hands-free kind of first-person approach on video content is very valuable. Also, with the ability of wearing the glass and having information overlaid over top of what you're seeing has a lot of potential as well. So things like augmented reality, virtual reality, things that add in some metadata around what you're looking at to provide some extended information of that tangible object with overlaid electronic media is also very exciting. And so trying to find that sweet spot there between teaching, learning, and technology is where we're focused, and having access to the technology is one piece. And that's one of the philosophies of a library in general, too, is just to provide access to faculty, staff, and students to technology that they may not have access to.
For instance, you've got a MakerBot Replicator 2. So that's a 3D printer?
That's perfect segue. Yeah, the 3D printer in the library is accessible to all students, faculty, and staff. And one of the neat things about it is that it allows students and folks that have interest in rapid prototyping or even just this whole ideation piece around conceptualizing some, maybe intangible object in a real world sort of 3D object is very, very exciting. The ability for students to access this technology has never been possible before. And so having this, the 3D MakerBot Replicator printer in the library allows students to come in and try some things out, things like printing an artwork piece, things like printing a prototype for perhaps a new business that they're interested in, working, for example, through the Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation at the campus, allowing students to try some new things and to actually make something. You know, so much about education, it seems, in the past has been sort of a consumer approach. You know, you receive information. And so this is really more about knowledge creation. So being able to build something and to create your own objects really creates a interesting sort of maker space and provide that ability to do so in a very cost-effective way.
Eric, are there professors and instructors that maybe are having a hard time wrapping their minds around using this new technology?
Yes, and that's where you don't know what you don't know sometimes. And so one of the facets of the showcase is to ask the questions and allow a safe space to ask questions. Well, what would it look like if we did have this technology? And so exploring things is one of the one of the goals, and one of the nice parts about the showcase is the relationship with the rest of the university. So being able to explore the technology but also receive help is definitely an important piece, so that there's some guidance and coaching that goes on along the way.
Eric, as you're doing this exploring, how do you know where the boundary is between using a piece of technology to good purpose in a classroom or teaching setting versus just using it to use it?
Correct. Yeah, that's so important. It really is all about pushing the boundaries. But, what we usually try to do is start with an instructional problem that we're trying to solve. So that, the focus is on technology, of course, but the focus really is around student learning and student achievement. So how do we take, a difficult concept that's, very challenging to explain, perhaps, or very difficult to visualize, and how do we apply technology to that as a solution set? So an example might be there, it's very difficult to visualize 3D protein molecules in the classroom. So how do we take advantage of 3D projection technology then to equip classrooms at the campus to allow students to better visualize very complex molecules, very, difficult to understand visualizations? And so that's where the potential, I think, of the technology comes in. If it's set with the framework and the lens of, you know, here's a instructional problem that we're trying to solve.
Interesting stuff. What is your vision of the classroom of the future?
You know what? I think we are. It's up to us to envision the future, and I think technology that we have access to has allowed us to re-envision the classroom, re-envision what we do as faculty members, re-envision how we learn as students, and so I think we're shaping it as we go. You know, the impact of just the whole consumerization of technology, I think, is transforming education. You know, the ability of learning outside the boundaries of the classroom is definitely possible now and will continue in the future. I think unbundling, you know, sort of that time, place, bound factor that you have, you know, when you're face-to-face, and better leveraging the technology to continue education beyond the classroom is where I think we're headed. I think maximizing the face-to-face time, too, through, like, maybe flipped classroom models or different types of technologies that can shift some of the content to sort of offline, maybe personalized or individualized learning, but then maximize that face-to-face time that's so valuable.
Eric Cunnan is Emerging Technologies Coordinator at Grand Valley State University. Eric, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
General Motors CEO Mary Barra is back on Capitol Hill tomorrow for her fourth appearance before Congress.
This is an extraordinary situation. It involves vehicles we no longer make. But it came to light on my watch, so it is my responsibility to resolve it.
Barra is back in the congressional hot seat, and she'll have some explaining to do. We'll get the latest tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saade, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.